Good morning.
Good morning, thank you.
I felt like it was
lovely, thank you very much.
Planning to present first.
Lovely, good.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Today we are very privileged to have Professor Charles Goodhart with us. I could be talking the whole class about Professor Charles Goodhart, but I know he doesn't like it, so I will just say that he's the world's leading authority in central banking, the person that has written, advised, and spoken best and most about central banking over the last decades, and he's also at the personal level someone I regard as a maestro. So I'm very grateful that he accepted my invitation to come one last time to teach all of you. And what he's going to do is a tour de force, on starting with a little bit on the beginning of central banking and then moving on to financial supervision from a historical perspective. This class will really help you to put the whole context and the whole subject of the first term in the proper background, in the proper historical and both regulatory and economic context. So without further ado, I pass the word on to him. I will be sitting down there with my leg up, as you know, and we will take a little break at 11, and then we will finish promptly at 12 because he needs to take a train later on. So with great thanks for being with us today, the floor is all yours.
Rosa, thank you very much indeed. Rosa and I go back really quite a long way. It's always been a great privilege and a pleasure to work with her. But all things come to an end, and next year I shall be 80, and my wife has sort of promised my wife that I won't go on sort of doing lectures and so on. I'd like to start with some history about how bank supervision developed over time. So I think it's always a good idea to learn how things started and grew. And I'm going to go back even further than my birthday. So beyond 80 years ago, I'm going to go back really right back to the, other way. To the start of central banking. And central banks were initially set up to provide funding and other banking services to governments. And indeed, most of them, the very early ones, were set up during wartime when governments were very short of money. And they provided a charter to a national bank to raise money which they could pay troops and so on. And this was so in 1694, when, as usual, the British were fighting the French. And it was also true of the Banque de France in 1805, when the French were fighting the British. Now, the bank was set up by a group of merchants in the City of London, and they bought a whole series of lot of government debt, and the money went to the government. Now, in return for that, they were granted a number of competitive advantages, a special charter to be a joint stock company, In those days, almost all companies were private, were partnerships, unlimited liability. And they had monopoly of joint stock banking in the capital city. And that was true again in the Banque de France. Now, they weren't central banks in the old days in the way that we think of as central banks, which is effectively almost entirely a sort of public sector regulatory and policy setting institution, which actually is part of the public sector, even though it's independent. To use a phrase that I think it was one of the American central bankers used, central banks are independent within the government. Initially, because of the advantages they were granted, they became by far and away the strongest commercial bank in the country. The Bank of England, until about the 1850s, was actually the largest single bank in the UK. And by far and away the largest bank in London, the capital and centre of the UK. Now, that meant that the other banks, which were mainly small private partnerships, and there were limits on the number of partners, they were quite weak, they were quite small, used the Bank of England in exactly the same way as you and I use our banks. In other words, there was a straightforward banking relationship. So what they did was they centralized their reserves. In other words, the small country banks wanted to hold cash, and they held cash because it was advantageous with the Bank of England, exactly the same way as you hold your money balances with your bank. So they centralized the reserves. Almost all the banks held their reserves at the Bank of England. And the payment mechanism was done. In other words, if a bank had to make a payment to another bank because a check had been drawn on it to pay to an account of another bank, the payment mechanism worked by a transfer from the reserve bank, from the reserves of private bank A, held at the Bank of England in London, to the reserves of private bank B, also held with the Bank of England in London. So the payment mechanism, and indeed the settlement mechanism, worked through the Bank of England, which in effect was almost one of the early clearing houses. And exactly the same way as when you run into temporary difficulties, liquidity difficulties, you may, at any rate if you are lucky, go to your clearing bank or to your bank and say, can you possibly lend me some money, give me an overdraft for a short period of time, which I need until such and such will enable me to pay you back. So the small private banks, when they find themselves short of liquidity, would borrow from the Bank of England. Exactly, it was a basic standard banking mechanism. So all the small banks sort of dotted around the country, which was the way banking was done in those days, had this banking mechanism with the Bank of England. Now, the Bank of England was also the government's bank, and it was held the main gold reserves, because we were on the gold standard. And so as the government's bank, the biggest bank, the central bank, it already had responsibility for maintaining the gold reserves of the country. But that led to a number of problems. One of the first ones was the gold wasn't interest-bearing. It provided no income for you. So there's a conflict between the Bank of England wanting to keep its profits up as an ordinary commercial bank and holding sufficient reserves to see the country through periods when the balance of payments was going wrong. And one of the answers that was attempted to be developed to that was to separate the Bank of England into two departments, an issue and a banking department. And indeed, the statistics of the Bank of England until about, I think it was 10 or 15 years ago, still divided the bank into an issue and a banking department, although it had absolutely zero economic relevance. Now, in the those days, the Issue Department was actually a currency board. And what it did was insofar as gold was deposited with the bank, it could then issue more notes against the gold. And when gold fled the Bank of England, it had to actually reduce its note issue. Whereas the banking department was supposed to work as an ordinary commercial bank. So that the idea was you separated the role of the Bank of England as the holder of the country's gold reserves, and the maintenance of the gold standard, from the Bank of England's commercial banking operation. Now, that was actually the brainchild of one of the UK's great economists called David Ricardo. And a lot of what David Ricardo wanted to do still hangs on in, for example, in the proposals nowadays, what is known as narrow banks. And the idea is that you try and separate financial intermediation, loan making, from providing the monetary base of the country as a whole. Now, Ricardo's idea and this separation into the Issue Department and Banking Department actually didn't work. And it didn't work because other banks still wanted to withdraw gold and Bank of England notes from the bank at a time of crisis and panic by borrowing from the bank. Now, this meant that the Bank of England was conflicted, because if you wanted to protect, maintain the UK on the gold standard and sort of have enough gold, then to protect against an external drain and gold leaving the country, the bank would want to restrict the number of loans that it was making in order to ensure that it would maintain enough gold. But to dampen the internal crisis, the panic internally, where people were desperately trying to borrow Bank of England notes and or gold from the Bank of England, the bank needed to lend freely, the lender of last resort. Now, the solution to that was developed by Henry Thornton in a great book in 1804 called The Paper Credit of Great Britain. The book that people know about is by Walter Bagehot called Lombard Street in 1873. In fact, Henry Thornton's book is much better. Walter Bagehot was, like all too many academics, doesn't give enough credit where credit is due. And Bagehot doesn't even mention Henry Thornton, doesn't refer to him in Lombard Street. And there is nothing in Lombard Street which actually Henry Thornton didn't do better. But the solution they found was that what you do is that in order to try and deal with the panic, to give an example of a panic, and take the situation after Lehman failed, and everyone was worried about, you know, is my bank going to be solvent? What's going to happen to the financial system? Now, what you do then is that you lend freely. You make liquidity very easily available. But you do so at a high, relatively high rate of interest. Now, a lot of people, again, mistake Bagehot and say that you should lend at a penalty, at a rate that is higher than the going market rate. And that is actually not true. What Bagehot said was you should lend at a high rate. But to Walter Bagehot, the UK, the interest rates in the UK, sort of over the period in which he lived, sort of from, he wrote in 1873, from, say, the 1820s to the 1870s, sort of averaged about 3 or 4%. So to Bagehot, a high rate was 6%. Now, during a panic, market rates can go very, very much higher than that, because money simply isn't available. From, you know, you can't get money because everyone wants to hoard it. So although Bagehot had a high rate, frequently that high rate was lower than the market rates that were in existence at the time. Now, the second thing that he said, and so did Henry Thornton, was seek acceptable collateral and know your customer. And again, it's difficult to know your customer in those days because there was very little transparency. The banks did not publish balance sheets. Indeed, as private banks, they weren't required to. And so the Bank of England had limited knowledge. So what it seek acceptable collateral and know your customer, what that actually meant was that you would lend on the basis of collateral, i.e. an asset that the which would be placed with the Bank of England and which the Bank of England could seize if it was the loan was not repaid. Now, the collateral that the Bank of England required was either government debt or debt that the Bank of England was fairly sure would get repaid. And the debt that the Bank of England was fairly sure would get repaid were commercial bills of exchange that were based on real activity, trade, or working capital, or what have you. And that gave rise to what is known as the real bills doctrine, which was the main basic underlying theory of the time. Now, the real bills doctrine was that banks should lend only against relatively short-term loans, again backed by bills of exchange that in turn were related to trade and output. And that actually unified at that time and during the whole period that the real bills doctrine was underway, the desire for monetary policy stability, price stability, with the desire for financial stability. And it sort of worked this way, if I can do it. And the standard quantity worked. It's not working. Let's see if I can. So the idea is that if you assume velocity is given or trended, that if you increase the money stock faster than the rate of growth of output, then you will get an inflation. And you don't want inflation. So that what you want to do is to increase M in line with an increase in output. Now, the real bills doctrine assumed that as you got an increase in output and trade, you would get an increase in bills of exchange related to output and trade. So if you only lent against bills related to output and trade, short-term commercial bills of exchange, then you would not get inflation. But equally, if you lent against bills of exchange that were based on trade and output, you knew that they would get, that the loan would get repaid. Because when the working capital, the trade, finance, whatever, actually subsequently led to sales, you would get repaid out of the purchase of sales. So the real bills doctrine was actually, in a way, lovely, because it unified the price stability concern of the central bank with the financial stability concern of the central bank. Now, why did it actually ultimately collapse in the Great Depression? In 1930s, which was, it dominated most central banking theory until then, as you could find. And the answer is that it doesn't quite work that way, because if you get a really big crisis, a really big depression, as the Americans had in 1929-33. The amount of bills of exchange go down so much that there are not enough to put with the central bank so the central bank can expand the money supply to restore the economy to equilibrium. So that the Fed made the mistake in 1929-33 of restricting its expansionary monetary actions again to the amount of bills of exchange and what have you that it could lend against. And there weren't any, because trade and output had simply collapsed. And Friedman and Schwartz, in their great monetary history of the United States, say that the great failure of the Fed in those days was that they didn't think about increasing the money supply sufficiently in other ways enough to stabilize the rate of growth of output. So the real bills doctrine is primarily now, unfortunately, of historical interest. Now, and you probably heard of the Taylor reaction function, whereby the central bank should expand or change interest rates depending on the deviation of inflation from the desired rate and the deviation of output from the desired level, so that the interest rate should be some constant plus where pi is the rate of inflation and pi star is the desired rate. And again, you've got the deviation of output from the natural rate or the equilibrium rate of output. Now, in fact, in the 19th century, the Bank of England had really something very similar to known as the Palmer Rules, because under then we were operating on a gold standard regime. So the idea was that the interest rate should vary depending on the proportion or the availability of excess Bank of England notes, which depended on the availability of gold. So as the gold balance declined, you would raise interest rates, and as the volume of gold increased in the country, the balance of payments was better, you would decrease. One of the problems that they had was how do you make the interest rate effective? And the answer to that, during periods of calm when liquidity was plentiful. And the answer to that was that you removed liquidity by open market operations and you had repos on consols. Effectively, you sold consols to the financial system against a promise to repay consols for them to put the consols back. And you withdrew cash from the system. Now, the remaining problem was that, as I said, the central bank in the 19th century was, until the 1850s, the main commercial bank in the system. After the 1850s, there was an increasing ability of banks to form limited liability joint stock banks. And there was an increasing desire, particularly on the European continent, to have larger universal banks. Because what was occurring was that in the 19th century, the scale of manufacturing and other endeavors was becoming relatively larger. There was development of iron and steel, a development of railways, and such and such. And the small private banks simply couldn't finance them. They weren't big enough. And that meant that there was a move towards having larger banks. And in the second half of the 19th century, the private banks began to have a merger. There was a whole series of mergers. And so that by the time you got to about 1900, the number of banks which had run into the hundreds in the 19th century was reduced to effectively about 10 to 20. And they became much larger than the Bank of England. Banks like Barclays Bank, Midland Bank, Lloyds Bank, and so on, developed and grew to very much larger. But the Bank of England, in the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, both competed with as a commercial bank and sought some control over these other commercial banks. In other words, the Bank of England wanted to maintain, and their main supervisory role was to try and set the acceptable quality of bills of exchange against which they lent. They also set the interest rate. They did the emergency lending, lender of last resort. even when the other commercial banks were often very much or were becoming very much larger. There was a great rivalry between the commercial banks and the Bank of England in 1900 to 1910. And the commercial banks in the UK at that time even thought of challenging the Bank of England's supremacy by establishing their own separate gold stock. Eventually, we got a little concordat between the Bank of England and the commercial banks, in which the Bank of England withdrew from undertaking commercial activity. It said that it would accept no more clients outside of its own staff. And as its existing clients would have ran off, it wouldn't try and replace them. So the commercial bank withdrew from commercial banking ventures, as did most other central banks at the time. And what's more, they established, in order to avoid having to deal directly with these very large commercial banks, a group of intermediaries between the commercial banks and themselves called the discount market, which was a major player in the London financial system from about the 1880s until about the beginning of the 1990s. Again, that's now history. But the idea was that the Bank of England actually consciously supported a group of relatively small financial institutions who borrowed normally from the commercial banks. And when the Bank of England was trying to withdraw money, it would make the discount houses short. And the discount houses would bid up the rate of interest. And when the commercial banks were short of money, they would withdraw the money that they put with the discount houses, and the Bank of England would replace it. So that the Bank of England didn't have to deal directly with these few monster commercial banks. It could do it all through the discount market. Now, I know that's all history, but it didn't really come to an end until the Big Bang in 1985, when a whole slew of foreign banks, primarily but not only the American banks, came into London. And there were then again so many banks that the Bank of England didn't feel threatened by having to deal with the odd commercial bank, which was much, much larger than itself. And the discount market, as a result, was no longer valuable to the Bank of England. And was effectively closed down in the 1990s. So by 1914, the central bank in almost every country, including the US, which established its Federal Reserve in 1913, was almost always involved in settlement, and often, though not all, invariably in clearing of payments. It set the interest rates. It provided lender of last resort liquidity facilities in emergencies. And it operated in foreign exchange markets to maintain the gold standard. That was what central banks did until World War I. There was little or no direct supervision of other banks. Although the Bank of England was one of its main functions, as indeed with other central banks, was to prevent panics by operating the Badgett-Thornton approach of making liquidity easily available, but at high interest rates during panics. And the general managers of the London clearing banks would not have let Bank of England officials through the front door at all. The quality control was via the oversight of the operating of the commercial bill market. There was some market intelligence, and the court of the Bank of England was filled with city notables, though not commercial banks, because remember, commercial banks were rivals, and competitors had been for a very long time of the central bank. Now, the world the financial world, which had really become stable, or had been stable from 1815, the end of the Napoleonic Wars, to 1914, broke down more or less entirely as a result of World War I and in the Great Depression in 1929-1933. World War I was so catastrophic that the amount of wartime finance, in many cases inflationary wartime finance, was such that the countries involved could not maintain the gold standard, though the UK did for a time. As in World War II, the US, which was not a participant in the war until very late on, 1917, was really the only one left standing. And again, it led to enormous imbalances, because almost all the gold in the world, a great deal of it, which had been in much of it in Europe, was sent over to the US in order to pay for munitions and so on. So that by 1918, the gold, which had previously been spread relatively evenly over all the central banks, was concentrated in the US. Now, some countries, notably France, realized that trying to get back, given a state where they had very, very much higher inflation after World War I, that they would find it extraordinarily difficult to get back to their pre-war parity, decided that they wouldn't even try. And that, whereas other countries did try. And that meant that the French had a very much devalued or undervalued exchange rate. And that meant that they became the recipient, because their balance of payments was in very strong relative to the other countries. And so that much of the gold was actually either from about 1922-23 onwards, it was either in France or it was in the US. And countries like the UK, Germany, Austria, Italy and others were left with virtually none. And meanwhile, the attempt to get back to the old gold standard parity meant that there was a kind of an austerity. And again, there was a problem with the very high debt ratio that we had in World War I. Rather like, if you like, with the Eurozone now, with the very high debt ratios and the worry about austerity. That meant, of course, that growth was pretty slow and difficult in Europe in those days. And of course that led to political pressures, just as it's leading to political pressures in the Eurozone now. And the political pressures at times meant that countries simply couldn't go on with the austerity that had occurred, weren't prepared to. And again, that led, among other things, to the breakdown of the gold standard, together with the financial crisis that occurred in the US. And so the gold standard broke up. And the whole sort of idea, the regime that we'd had previously about how the system worked, sort of collapsed. Now that collapse and the collapse of many of the banks in Europe, Creditanstalt in Austria, the various banking collapses in Germany, and the depressions elsewhere, didn't lead from calls for more central bank supervision. Instead, what we got in the context of much higher unemployment, generalized deflation of a much greater extent than we've got now, and a growing move towards socialism as a sort of a generalized political theory, led instead to a number of developments. Low fixed nominal interest rates, much more direct government controls on banking activities, particularly exacerbated by World War II. And if you were in a war, what you wanted to do was actually restrict people spending for themselves on consumption, and you wanted to restrict non-essential investment in order to transfer all resources, and including the men were to go into the armies, and the women were to replace the men in the factories. And so you wanted to get, and the factories were to produce war material. So you wanted to limit the amount of finance that would be provided for these non-essential purposes. And so effectively what they did, governments, was they simply imposed controls on the banks. Thou shalt not lend for consumption. And after the war, these controls, the direct controls on bank lending, continued until the early 1970s. The way that the authorities controlled bank lending and monetary growth was by simply saying to the banks that there's going to be a limit, a ceiling, to the amount that you can lend. There was an increase in deposit insurance in some countries to prevent sort of runs on banks, and there was a great deal of encouragement on cartelization. That is, all financial institutions of a particular kind were encouraged to get together and set a generally agreed interest rate. One of the arguments about what had happened in 1929-33 was that this had been induced by excess competition, because excess competition does, and as it's intended to, drive down the margins that banks can charge. In other words, a competitor, in order to increase their business, will raise its deposit rate in order to get more deposits and lower the rate that it offers on loans in order to make more loans. So the more competitors you've got, the more deposit rates rise relative to loan rates and the smaller the margin. If you've got margins that are very small and you want to maintain your return on equity, what you do is you actually undertake riskier activities because they pay a higher rate of interest. What's more, with these very low margins, it encourages higher deposit rates, lower loan rates. It encourages both loan expansion and increase in deposits, so it encourages leverage. So that the more competition you've got, the greater the instability of your system. And the whole idea of the various measures that were introduced in the 30s was to restrict competition. Glass-Steagall was nothing to do with investment banking. It was all about restricting competition. The Building Societies Association, again, until the 1980s, the interest rate that you could get on a mortgage was determined by a cartel of building societies. That cartel had been strictly encouraged. For reasons that I find very difficult entirely to understand, the message that more competition and challenger banks increases the aggregate instability of the system seems to have been completely forgotten or disagreed, because present government and many of those in power are arguing that what we need is more competition. Now, competition is good for the consumer and the user of the bank at the point of time in which you're dealing. And there's no question about it, competition will get you better terms. And so the consumer authorities are always going to be crying for more competition, for very standard and obvious reasons. But it will have an implication for financial stability that you have to be aware of. Now, what occurred was that interest rates were fixed and held very low because inflation was relatively low. The banks became almost sort of offshoots of the public sector. People sort of hark back to the golden days of retail banking in the post-war world. I can tell you they weren't golden. The Captain Mannerings, if you watch Dad's Army, Captain Mannering, who was the bank manager, I can't remember what the town is called, Captain Mannering would not have been allowed to lend money to any of you or me. Essentially, what Captain Mannering could do was strictly determined by the government. There was no competition. There was virtually no provision of consumer loans, and mortgages were done through the building societies rather than the banks, and bank lending was strictly controlled. And that meant that we had very few banking crises. Banks could only really lend to the government and to big business, particularly exports. And banks were not allowed to lend to importers, they were not allowed to lend to consumers. House mortgages came from an entirely different group, again, strictly controlled, the building societies. Now, in practice, after World War II, Keynesian ideas about demand management had become established. And we found ourselves able, by using fiscal and monetary policy, to undertake much more control of the level of demand and therefore employment and unemployment than we had before. Now, if you were to say 60 years old, let's say we were 100 years old in 1945, what you would have seen was that during peacetime, prices were either stable or they declined, as in the interwar period. The price level in the UK in 1914 was more or less identical to the price level in 1815. The price level in 1939 was significantly below the price level, and I think it was 1920. And people had been scarred by the experience of the interwar period. So it may now seem sort of extraordinary, but in practice, between about 1945 and 1950, most people thought that there would not be no inflation, or there'd be deflation. People were much more worried about deflation than inflation in the immediate post-war period. But it didn't work out like that, because for a variety of reasons, partly the Keynesian demand management, partly pent-up demand in the countries that had been destroyed by war, partly extraordinarily beneficial policymaking by the US with the Marshall Plan, in practice we returned to full or maybe over full employment. And rather than going down, inflation began to creep upwards. 3, then 4, then 5%, that sort of thing. It took a long time, but eventually, in the 50s and 60s, people began to realize that with this kind of Keynesian demand management and the political pressures to keep employment very high, there was much more likely to be inflation than deflation. And that led to a whole series of sort of policy changes and sort of inflationary pressures, which mounted through to the 1970s, together with the development of information technology and the increasing globalization of the system, which led to a desire to get away all of this from the constraints and restraints the governments had put on our financial system up to about the 1970s. So there was a whole process of liberalization. Now, the liberalization, which enabled banks to do what they wanted to do, actually brought back the banking crises. And they began in the 1970s. We had one of the first lot of banking crises, 73, 74. When we liberalized, the banks all went out on a little bender and tried to get bigger and bigger. They increasingly lent against property, which they hadn't been really allowed to do beforehand. There was a property boom, and then there was a crash. I've lived through 3 crises in this country, all have been related to bad bank lending on housing and property. And this is standard. There was the US savings and loans crisis in the 1980s, Japanese crisis in the 1990s, Scandinavia in 1989-92, a whole series of these. Initially, the central banks were quite unprepared for this because they hadn't experienced this kind of thing. There was nobody working in the central bank in 1973-74 who had actually been there in the 1930s. And the unlike the interwar crises, when the conclusion was that there was too much competition and you should cartelize everything and control it, the conclusion that was drawn from these post-liberalization banking crises was that the deficiency was insufficient supervision, and that the cure was more supervision, often, but not always, by the central bank. So the sort of supervision and regulation which is now pervasive really only sort of goes back to the 1970s. You mustn't think of these things as necessarily being actually fixed in stone. These sort of approaches to how you deal with your banking system and the work of the central bank changes over time. And a major problem was that liberalization plus technology led to global banking. So the regulation in one country would lead to disintermediation in the sense that if we impose tougher regulations on British banks, then sort of businesses would go to French or German or American banks. So there was a desire to maintain a level playing field. And even the Americans were startled by the degree to which we suddenly developed a massive global wholesale markets in the form of the Eurodollar markets, which started in the 60s and 70s. And the answer to that was, how do you deal with trying to maintain a level playing field, was to get all the regulators, or rather all the central banks, together and in the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. Meanwhile, the emphasis was shifting from liquidity. And in the old days, there used to be quite a lot of capital, and banks closed because they ran out of money. So what you did was that you imposed cash ratios and liquidity ratios, and banks had to hold more cash and liquid assets. But the development of these huge global wholesale markets, like the Euro-dollar market, meant that increasingly you could borrow whenever you wanted. So if you just ran out of money, you didn't have to have cash or commercial bills. You would just borrow from the wholesale market. But you could only borrow from the wholesale market, raise money by issuing CDs or whatever, if people were confident that they would get paid back. And they would only be confident if they get paid back if you had enough capital, if you could absorb losses. So in normal times, a clearly solvent bank can always buy in the required liquidity. And that was one of the reasons why the kind of ratio controls that I initially grew up with, the liquidity, cash ratios and liquid assets ratios, have been completely dropped until a few years ago, when we now have come back to the liquidity coverage ratio and the net stable financing rate, NSFR. But what the problem with borrowing from wholesale markets is it depends on these wholesale markets always being available. And markets tend to be rather flighty. And when there is panic around and you don't know quite who is solvent and who isn't, these markets tend to close up. And these notes were written before 2008. And the examples here that I gave were 1998, when a very large hedge fund called LTCM would break down in New York, and there was a temporary period when the markets became, again, not fully available, and 9/11, when again, for a few days, the markets were in disarray. But of course, none of this collapse of these wholesale markets was anything like the collapse that occurred after the default of Lehman Brothers in the autumn of 2008, when the whole of the global wholesale markets simply became dysfunctional. And the central banks around the world had to step in one way and another to pump in masses and masses and masses of liquidity into the system, which they're still doing. So bank crises not only became quite common, but they were also extremely expensive because of bailout. And so the ministries of finance played a larger role. And frequently, these crises were blamed on the supervisors. And central banks needed credibility of macro monetary policy. And that was one of the reasons why in 1997, when the Bank of England was given a more operational and independent role for setting interest rates, at the same time Gordon Brown removed supervision, which the Bank of England had been doing, and put it with a separate authority, the FSA, so to try and sort of leave the central bank concentrating on its price stability objective, with the financial stability to be done by a troika of the FSA, which was to do the supervision, the Bank of England, which was to do lender of last resort if necessary, and the Treasury. Now, unfortunately, it has now been tested. It was tested in the case of Northern Rock, and it failed. It failed because there was disagreement between the members of the Troika, and sufficient disagreement so that, in practice, the Bank of England vetoed the provision of liquidity support to a failing bank, Northern Rock, until it was too late. As a result, when the Conservatives got back in 2010, put the bulk of the FSA, the supervisory body, back into the Bank of England under the heading of the PRA, the Prudential Regulatory Authority, leaving conduct of business in a separate independent body called the Financial Conduct Authority. And that's the end of the historical stuff, and we will go to 5 to 11. This almost perfect timing. Unless if anyone's got a question about history, I'm very happy to take it.
Yes. I'll pick up one. Two particular countries didn't have a financial crisis recently, the Australians and the Canadians. They have allegedly very cartelized banking systems,
yes,
with very poor big dominant banks in each one. And Professor Bodo says that this is the way that we ought to go. What do you think?
Well, in Canada and Australia had a protected home market. The profit margins were higher. But it means that the advantages of competition are not there. And the American banks, are not allowed to compete in Canada. And the foreign banks are not allowed to compete in Australia. I don't think that we could do it in the UK because we are the largest international offshore banking center in the world. We talk about offshore centers, we are it. New York is a larger banking center, but it does American business only, really. Well, it does a bit of international. And again, Tokyo is at least as large, but it only does effectively Japanese business. We are the center par excellence, which arranges international financing, where foreigners put their money and we lend more to foreigners. We're intermediaries, not just within the UK, but we intermediate between people from every country. And the latest stage in this has been, is and is going to be, that we have advocated and are going to take over the international offshore renminbi business in China. So there are tens, almost hundreds, of foreign banks in London, and I think it would be much more difficult for us doing international intermediation to do this kind of restriction of the kind of banking business. And again, it runs against all the sort of the arguments in favor of challenger banks. For example, and now my memory is going a bit, the bank which is most beloved of our current sort of authorities is a Swedish bank. Can you remember?
Handelsbank.
Handelsbanking. And it does very good retail business. It provides very good terms for customers. It only does retail business. And if you ask most people in the Treasury Select Committee and probably in the Treasury which bank they regard as best of breed, they would probably say Handelsbank. So I don't think that we could. Many other countries might follow that kind of route. I don't think it's open to the UK, partly because the intellectual fashion, and remember intellectual fashions change, is that rather than competition being a bad thing, which was the view between the 1930s and the 1960s, is that competition is now a good thing, and competition is very largely provided frequently by foreign banks. If you really want to avoid a financial crisis, you probably do best to have a nice cozy cartel, as the Canadians and the Australians, and to a large extent the Indians had as well. And you can't set up a bank in India. Everything is under the control of the government, and it is very politically dominated. So I think we've got to 11. If this is any...
Perfect. We'll take now a five-minute break, and we'll come back in 5 minutes for the second part of this fascinating...
Very good. It's interesting the parallel between insurance regulations and vision, which largely came out of the collapse of BNG in the late 60s, and the first insurance regulation in the early 1970s, which predated the banking regulation, and was like a leapfrog between the insurance and banking regulations.
Yeah, I'm not sure that solvency is a good idea.
It's Solvency II is parallels the Basel, but it's aimed at a completely different type.
Yeah, and I don't. You see, the central bankers and most regulators actually do know quite a lot about banks, and know virtually nothing about insurance companies. Lovely.
Because they say that one institution has always existed when you have a state, and the income is that. They said some states can get away from not having armies, but they always have a bank. And it's that symbiotic relationship in which they examine between the bank and the bank is done. And essentially, the banks talk more of the political framework and vice versa. It's Mexico, it's Brazil.
This
Very good. I forgot about
that. So, one of my administrators will contact me. I think they will accept the ask for the and I will just do a one-off payment, possibly a little bit much more complicated than that. That will happen within the next 2 weeks. So, you will hear from me back in the so they will see what they got. So, they can do it. And then, when I was there in Brussels, there was a great deal of interest in some of the questions that you had raised.
Right.
And so they may come back to us for another paper and we'll show.
Let's begin again, so I got to leave pretty promptly at 12. And in the first hour, I was really talking almost entirely about history. And now, of course, everyone is particularly interested about current recent developments, and which have been extreme. The financial crisis that hit in began in 2007, with Northern Rock in this country, with a decline in housing markets and with a weakness in mortgage-related markets in 2007. And then it went from bad to worse in 2008 with one of the big American investment banks, Bear Stearns, having to be bailed out in March, April. And then the two publicly supported, government-supported entities, or GSEs, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which do mortgage insurance in the United States, having to be taken into a form of nationalization called conservatorship, and then having bailed out, or in a sense having supported the merger of Bear Stearns with J.P. Morgan and the conservatorship of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the Republican government felt that they simply could not undertake, for political reasons, a further bailout support using taxpayer money of Lehman Brothers. They had hoped that Barclays was going to take over Lehman Brothers, but the British authorities, in my view, quite rightly, forbade that. And so the weekend that Lehman's didn't have enough money, enough finance to continue over into the next week, led to its liquidation. And that led to a really chaotic period between the sort of failure of Lehman Brothers and about the next 2 months, which were total disaster. The decline in the output, trade, employment between Q4 2008 and Q1 2009 was more severe, more deep than the decline in 1929 had been. That was then halted by some remarkably successful central bank and government activities to prevent further financial intermediary failures, to guarantee the money market mutual funds in the United States, to pump liquidity into the system, and to do the first round of quantitative easing to push money into the system and lower interest rates to a degree that led to a recovery, restoration of confidence and in asset prices, and markets began to recover from effectively May, June 2009, particularly with the support of the stress tests on the American banks, which was backstopped by the availability of government money under the TARP, or Troubled Asset Recovery Program, which enabled any bank or the main American banks which didn't have sufficient capital to be recapitalized out of public funds, which was a great success. Anyhow, let's go to the post-crisis regulatory agenda. Now, prior to 2007-08, there were a number of comfortable myths that almost everybody believed. The first one was that successful inflation targeting would prevent macro disturbances, that as long as you maintain price stability, that the economy and the system would continue in a very stable way. I suppose the iconic example of that was Gordon Brown's statement about having abolished boom and bust. What they had all failed to realize, and what had been forgotten, was the analysis that an American economist called Hyman Minsky had developed, which was that macroeconomic stability and financial stability did not go hand in hand. The reason for that was that if you've got much more macroeconomic stability, it seems that risk is much lower. Risk is much lower, particularly if interest rates are somewhat low. You will reach for yield, and you feel that you can afford to take on a more highly leveraged, much more ratio, higher ratio of debt to equity. And it is notable that all the really, really serious financial collapses of the last 120 years have been after outstanding periods of macroeconomic success. The 1929-33 crisis, which had its epicenter in the US, occurred after the 1920s, which was one of the greatest periods of economic development in the United States ever. And there was relatively low inflation, very rapid rate of growth of output. So all the consumer durables were coming down the line. You had telephones, cars, refrigerators. And American society was, and their economic society was developing enormously well. And people extrapolated into the far distant future. Again, the Japanese crisis, which began in 1991, came after the 1980s. And the 1980s, again, saw Japanese inflation fairly stable, low, and the Japanese rate of growth at the time was still 7-8% per annum. I remember in about 1989-1988, the Japanese were taking over everything. They were buying Radio City Center in the US. Out of the top five banks, the top four were Japanese, or four of the top five were Japanese. People said that the 21st century was going to be the Japanese century. And asset prices in Japan, because people extrapolated this, went through the roof. And one of the common saying was that the value of the emperor's grounds in the middle of Tokyo, as measured by Tokyo property prices, was greater than the value of the whole of California. It was all largely illusory. And China, very largely likely to be in much the same situation. People extrapolated Chinese growth. The Chinese will take over the world in the next sort of 10 or 20 years because their growth is going to be so high. But again, the asset prices, Shanghai stock market, the value of apartments in Beijing and Shanghai, such that one's got to sort of query these things. So that the idea that if you've got a stable macroeconomy, indeed if you've got a very well-developing macroeconomy, this will prevent financial instability, is just not true. The more that people think a country and its economy is going to sort of shoot ahead forever in a day, and the more likely it is that there may be trouble ahead. And it's exactly the same way. If any of you actually ever go and become a supervisor or have anything to do with regulation of banks, the bank that you really, really, really need to go over with a fine-tooth comb is the bank that is growing fastest. Indeed, the bank that is getting the most profits, and the bank that is the darling of the stock exchange, all of which were true of Northern Rock. Now, the second myth was that if you didn't have macroeconomic disturbances, that Basel II would guarantee bank solvency. Now, after 2008, we all discovered a lot of things were wrong with Basel II. We discovered that a lot of what was allowed to be included in the Basel II capital denominator were not effectively loss-absorbing, that the banks had continuously chipped away by... You'd ask for a regulator, can we put this in our Basel II capital denominator? And initially it would seem to be fairly not a problem. It was small and you could allow it. And so the regulators liked to keep on good terms with the banks. So they say would say yes, and then you get a sort of deluge of people following on under. And the Basel II requirements were manipulated. There was absolutely no doubt about that. When it came to it, the Basel II capital requirements were entirely insufficient. And then the argument was that given bank solvency, that the access to the wholesale markets through funding liquidity rather than holding liquid assets in your own books would always be assured, so you didn't have to worry about liquidity. And as Rosa will tell you, I wrote a book about the Basel Committee. It's a fairly specialized book because only a few people actually want to know about these sort of things. But the Basel Committee established these capital ratios with Basel I in the late 1980s, in about 88. And then they did try to establish a liquidity ratio along the lines of the capital ratio, but they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it because there'd been so much sort of energy spent in getting the capital ratio agreed between different countries with different viewpoints and different ways of regulating capital requirements, that they were exhausted. And what's more, they thought if you had a capital ratio in place, as in Basel I and Basel II, you didn't need a liquidity ratio, because this capital ratio would ensure solvency. If you had solvency, there would always be these well-functioning wholesale markets, and you could always get liquidity. And of course, that turned out to be totally untrue, because when the sort of the balloon went up, and people realized that they didn't know what the position of counterparties was, how solvent they were, what their real position was, they were very unwilling to undertake sort of transactions to put money into the interbank market through which other banks needing of funds could withdraw them. I mean, the interbank market effectively collapsed. So that the availability of liquidity declined really very sharply. And of course there was the view about that the efficient markets hypothesis, which essentially means that bankers always know exactly what they're doing and that they won't risk their bank failing. And one of the great tragedies of the whole thing was that the bankers actually did not actually believe that they were risking the bank. They did not think that they were taking risky bets. The problem was that they misinterpreted risk. And risk is very difficult to assess. And it's something we talk about all the time, but we don't really know exactly what the problem is. Now, the main problem, as almost always, as I said earlier, was an error on housing and property-related finance. It was particularly centered on U.S. housing, but it was also true in countries like Spain and Ireland. Now, why had this happened? It happened in part because of the connection between housing and politics. Your house, when eventually you get to have one, which has become more difficult because of the cost of housing, but we won't go into that. Your house, or the house of people, is going to be by far and away the largest element in their wealth. It's the largest single purchase that you will ever undertake, and it is regarded as politically desirable by almost every party, a political party, to encourage and enable as many people as possible within the population to be in a position to buy and stay in a house of their own. Now, the subprime market, and you've heard about subprime and all the rest of it, was actually encouraged and developed and supported by the politicians. It wouldn't have occurred otherwise. And it was done for the, if you like, for the most laudable and highest of motives. The idea of subprime was to try and ensure that the disadvantaged section of the American population would be able to get on the housing ladder. Although being disadvantaged, they had relatively few assets and relatively poor job opportunities. Now, how is this particular game to be done? How would you get someone with virtually no assets and very little in the way of or poor job opportunities? How could you do it? Well, the answer effectively was that as long as you believed that housing prices were always going to be stable or move upwards, it was actually very simple. As long as housing prices are stable and move upwards, the house is perfect collateral for the loan, so the lender won't lose. Now, how about the borrower? Now, assuming that they don't get into difficulties, if they get into difficulties and housing prices are stable or upwards, the lender simply repossesses and sells and doesn't make a loss because housing prices are stable or upwards. Now, let's assume that these are the quite large sector of the disadvantaged who can pay. Now, initially, they're offered a teaser rate, which is quite low and probably equivalent of the rental price of renting it instead of buying it. So it's not very high. But it only lasts for a few years, and then you get on to a much higher interest rate, which the idea is it would be too high for you to pay. But the idea of the process was that you never actually get to the reset where the interest rate is much higher. Because what you do is in the interim, the value of the house has gone up. You now have a larger equity stake. So you can remortgage and start with a new teaser rate. So effectively, you go on and on, not having to pay more than a rental amount, until you actually effectively own the house fully, ultimately, yourself. But it all depends on housing prices being stable or moving upwards. Now, given that basic dependence, the authorities pushed for subprime by requiring, actually ordering, the insurance institutions, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to take on board an increasing proportion of subprime and other low-rated, all-day type mortgage borrowers. Now, how could they do that? How could they think that? How could the credit rating agencies be prepared to give such a high rating to the securitizations, which were simply collections of these mortgage loans, some subprime, but not only subprime, which were put together and sold on? And the answer was econometrics. What had happened was that the Americans had wonderful statistics on everything that you could possibly think of about mortgage finance from the early 1950s, monthly. And from the early 1950s until 2006, which is about 56 years, about 50 years, 12 months a year, you've got 600 observations. Now, during that period, 600 observations, it was only in 1 or 2 months that if you had a regionally diversified portfolio of houses, that value of that portfolio would go down, and the most it went down was about 1.5%. It is true that certain regions had housing, sharp housing declines, New England and the Boston area in around 1992, the oil-producing areas, Texas and Oklahoma, in 1985-86. But if you had a regionally diversified portfolio, effectively, the value of houses was always either stable or going up. Now, you put 600 observations of this continuation into your econometric equation, and what you will find is that a decrease in the value of housing regionally diversified across the whole of the US of more than about 5% was sort of 1.5 standard deviations, and over 10% was sort of 2 or 3 standard deviations. In other words, it was unthinkable, which is an example why you should never put your trust in econometrics entirely. Because if you had looked at the US in 1929-33 and at a whole series of other countries and used a bit of common sense, you would have realized that the likelihood of a decline of housing prices was not sort of 2 or 3 standard deviations, in other words, almost unthinkable. I mean, it happened really quite often in the world, indeed in the US previously. Nevertheless, I think both the authorities and the CRAs, and to a large extent the supervisors, would have got stuck on this belief that housing prices was always a sort of a moving escalator upwards. And the supervisors had been told that the quality of origination of mortgage loans was reduced. But Ian Greenspan, although he'd been specifically told, I can't remember which member of the Board of Governors, was it who warned him? I can't remember. Greenspan had been specifically warned that mortgage finance was declining in quality. And because on liberal grounds did not like regulation, refused to do anything about it. The banks, again, were sucked into this belief that it wasn't risky to buy housing. The reason why Lehman's went down was nothing to do with sort of toxic derivatives or anything to do with that. It was a belief by Dick Fuld that if you held housing assets, mortgage-backed securities, that they would always recover, and that was the way to make a lot of money. And Lehman's went down because their warehousing of large volumes of MBS, mortgage-backed securities, which were lost value sharply with the decline of housing prices in 2007-2008, sunk it. Again, UBS, which was one of the main banks that ran into real difficulties, I held a very large volume of the highest, i.e. the most secure tranche of, again, of these securitized MBS mortgage-backed securities. They were AAA, and I think they were even sort of insured in various ways. And so the risk weighting of these AAA securities was effectively equivalent to zero. They didn't have to hold any capital against it. Now, the reason why they were granted AAA status was because it was thought that there was no likelihood that they would default, that they would go belly up. And actually, virtually none of them ever did. It wasn't that the AAA securities held by UBS defaulted. The problem was that in the sort of collapse of housing prices, and even worse, with the sort of total financial dysfunction that we got in sort of 2008-2009, the prices of these assets went way, way down because nobody knew quite how to value them. And they were all scared. And there were virtually no buyers, and there were a few sellers. When there are no buyers and a few sellers, prices rocket downwards. They didn't default, but the market value went down. Now, to some large extent, these, or very large extent, these were held on the trading book. And what is held on the trading book is required to be marked to market. In accounting terms, the valuation is what the market will pay for them at this moment. And the markets were so bad that, of course, they were prepared to pay very little. And that meant that the valuation, the accounting value of UBS's book, virtually none of which defaulted, sort of totally collapsed. And that went straight through to the P&L, the profit and loss account, and that went straight through to their capital adequacy, which then effectively failed. So that the banks simply didn't realize the kind of risk that they were taking on. They didn't appreciate it. Dick Ford had no idea that he was putting Lehman Brothers into a particularly risky position. So it's and a phrase that Bill White always uses, a friend of mine. It's not what you it's what really hits you is what you think that turns out not to be so. And it was basically an error of appreciation. It was an error of appreciation about the riskiness of housing-related and property-related lending that really killed it. It was nothing to do with investment banking casinos, the sort of thing that John Kay and to some extent Martin Wolf keep on going on about, about toxic derivatives and stuff. I'm not saying that they're safe, they're not. But it wasn't that. It wasn't derivatives, it wasn't sort of doing funny business that actually killed our banking system or really damaged it. It was basic rock standard stuff. It was a mistake about the riskiness of the property-related loans. So, what are we doing? What are the approaches? Well, there are two approaches, basically. There's let's go on doing what we've been doing before, but do it better. In other words, repair Basel. Much more capital. Mark Carney claims, I think slightly exaggerated, that the amount of core Tier 1 equity that the banks are now holding is 10 times what they held in 2007. Now, 10 may not be the right multiple, but it really is quite a lot. Again, the fact that the wholesale markets that banks had relied on for so much of their liquidity, if they got into difficulty, didn't work in 2008, means that we're going back to the stage of wanting to get the banks to hold enough cash, very liquid assets, high-quality liquid assets, or HQLA, as they're frequently referred to, so that they can ride through a period in which markets are not open and they have with large-scale withdrawals in the form of runs on deposits and so on that they have to meet. So we're going back to the liquidity requirements, and we are now adding a whole series of additional instruments which are meant to try and dampen the housing and property bubbles which have played such a major part in the financial crises of about the last 30 or 40 years. Increasing usage of time-varying loan-to-value ratios, loan-to-income ratios, debt service-to-income ratios, and all of that. They're increasingly beginning to be used. Then there are those who say that what is wrong is the structure of banking, that we ought to go back to Glass-Steagall, that it's wrong to have our money supply dependent on bank lending, that the money supply should be determined by some form of government control through narrow banks. Then there are those who say that the problem was that banks took too much sort of risk on through operating on their own account, and that we mustn't allow banks to undertake transactions, proprietary transactions from their own account, and that's the Volcker rules. Suggestions that the banks are too large to fail, they should be broken up. There was something in the press today where one, I think fairly nutty, member of parliament suggested that RBS should be broken up into 500 regional banks. none of which would be large enough to finance their corporate clients, but leave that alone. Then you've got the vicar's suggestion of separating the retail business from the investment banking business and ring-fencing the retail business on the grounds that that has to be protected, while the investment banking business doesn't. There's a sort of a light version of that which may or may not be introduced in the Eurozone, which goes by the name of the Liikanen. He was the governor of the Central Bank of Finland, and he was the chair of a committee looking at structural changes which might be introduced in the continent. It's likely to go nowhere because the French are very keen on their current universal banks, and the Liikanen would limit what the French universal banks could do. The Americans did it far better than the Europeans, because they put much more weight on the leverage ratio. The risk-weighted assets is a desire to relate the requirements for capital and perhaps for liquidity to the risk of the assets that you hold. Problem is, as I indicated, that you don't know really what risk is. As I said, the main problem in 2007-2009 was a failing to understand the risk on housing, and the risk weighting of housing for under political pressure is far below what the true relative riskiness of housing and property lending is. I talked about the AAA CDOs of UBS and sovereign debt, because there's a zero risk weight. I could go explain in the book on the Basel Committee how we got to that sort of silly position. But at the moment, if you ask where is the greatest bubble in the financial system, and the answer it is in sovereign debt. Because of the zero risk weight in sovereign debt, the fact that the banks can increase their holding of sovereign debt without having to put any capital behind it, most banks have increased their holdings of sovereign debt enormously, and the yields, the interest rate in sovereign debt has gone down to ridiculously low levels. In some cases, negative. You pay, in Germany, you pay to hold bonds. And the interest rate in Italian, Spanish debt is below that in American debt. And it's way out of any kind of kilter. And at some stage, this is going to snap back. This simply says that the risk weightings on risk-weighted assets is badly designed, and given its bad design, banks use it to try and increase their leverage and their position and their return because they're allowed to. And because it's badly designed, that actually has an effect on relative prices, which makes all the banks tend to go into an asset class, which then becomes wildly overvalued and at some point is likely to collapse. So although it sounds on the surface much better to relate capital and liquidity to the sort of your judgment about risk, because your judgment and anybody's judgment on risk is likely to be misguided, and because the banks will always take advantage of that misinterpretation of risk to rush into that sector where the risk requirement has been understated, and that leads to sort of inappropriate results. And every economist who studied this effectively has said that looking at simple leverage ratios is much better than looking at risk-weighted assets. On the other hand, the central bankers and the authorities, particularly in Europe, are simply not prepared to do it. Second reason why the Americans did it, because they put much more weight on the leverage ratio, is that they had public sector funding in the TARP monies with which they could recapitalize the banks. The Europeans did not. They had no public sector backstop of funding with which they could recapitalize the banks. The result was when the Europeans did their their stress tests, because they had no effective means of dealing with the banks who failed the stress tests, the stress tests were effectively reverse engineered so that only a few banks failed by a sufficiently small amount that it could be handled. The general belief among most commentators is that this remains true today, that because the Europeans are not prepared, including those of us in the UK, are not prepared to put public sector money into play in dealing with the bank's shortfall of equity relative to what is needed to make them properly resilient, that the stress tests that have been undertaken have understated the degree to which banks in many of the European countries are undercapitalized. The next one, again, is that when the Americans did their stress tests, they said that what we want is that you should bring your equity that you have up to the level that is sufficient to meet the ratio with regard to your liabilities, relevant liabilities, particularly deposits, that existed as of the time that the stress test was undertaken. In other words, you could not improve your equity ratio by deleveraging, and that is by selling assets and reducing the size of your book. The Europeans did not do that. Effectively, the Europeans said that what we want you to do is just have a higher equity ratio. We don't care how you do it. Now, you can improve your equity ratio either by trying to issue a lot more equity or retain all your earnings and not pay it out in dividends, or you can improve your equity ratio by getting rid of assets. Now, equity holders much prefer you to do it by deleveraging, and the senior bankers hold a lot of equity in their own banks, and they are ultimately responsible. They ultimately can be pushed around by the equity holders. So the managers want to do the same thing. So that the way that the European banks improved their equity ratio was by deleveraging. However, there was another particular sort of wrinkle, which is that in each country, the political authorities wanted their own banks, i.e. those headquartered in their own country, to go on lending to companies and households within their country. So that effectively in the UK, the authorities would say to HSBC, Barclays, whatever you do, go on lending more to SMEs in the UK and go on making mortgage loans in the UK. And of course they were in a position to do that. So what happened was that the deleveraging occurred by every headquartered bank reducing its lending abroad. In other words, cross-border lending went down with a bang, which meant that the European banking system, instead of being a unity, became totally fragmented. So effectively, let me go back a bit. In 2000, the amount of bank lending to the private sector in 2014 was slightly lower than the amount at the peak in 2007. I think my data are correct. However, the UK banks in 2014 were lending a lot more to the UK private sector than they were in 2007. The reason was that back in 2007, something like about 20% of total lending in the UK to the UK private sector was done by foreign banks. I many of them sort of, you know, with branches or subsidiaries in the UK, but nevertheless by foreign banks. Essentially, what happened is that bank lending into the UK from foreign banks has collapsed in exactly the same way that bank lending into Italy from foreign banks has collapsed. So that the European banking system has become totally fragmented. And as a result, what we have done is we've had a pressure, as a result of regulatory pressure, that has led to very considerable reduction in overall bank lending, essentially cross-border bank lending, in the European economies, which has been one of the reasons why there's been much slower growth of bank lending and money stock in Europe throughout than there was in America, and one of the reasons why the recovery from 2008-09 has been really much slower in Europe than in America. So it's not been one of our greatest moments. Now, I've talked actually about macroprudential. I've talked about the instruments. One of the problems is, can you use them? Because they're meant to be sort of done when countercyclically, so that when the economy is in trouble, you sort of remove relax your macroprudential. Now, can you relax your constraints, your restrictions, when everything is in a bust? Will anyone do it? Will they do it enough? Can we be sure that they will use the powers that they have on time and state varying capital requirements and LTVs and LTIs? And I don't know whether you read your press today, but particularly in the Financial Times, the argument was that we've got to, the recovery in the UK is sufficiently sluggish so that we don't want to, or rather the Bank of England, the MPC, does not want to raise interest rates. But the very slow growth of interest, or the rock bottom level of interest rates, provides a very considerable encouragement, because mortgage payments are obviously less, for people to buy housing. And with our very sluggish supply of housing, to raise housing prices. And if you get an increase in debt, of household debt, relative to household income, that is a potential danger in future. So according to page one, front page of the Financial Times, what Mark Carney is effectively saying is that in order to try and deal with the financial stability implications of very low for longer interest rates, he is thinking of using macroprudential instruments to restrain the credit and particularly the housing market. Now, will it be done? How will it be achieved? I mean, these are very new times and we don't honestly know. Now, I've got one more. What time have we got?
We've got 10 minutes.
Actually, I think I'll stop there, because I don't really have time to go through the final section in any case. So I've gone through quite a lot about what happened and why and what we're now doing. So can I take any questions on the financial crisis and what's been done? Yes?
You mentioned that the limited sanctions were not the cause of the financial crisis, but then why so much emphasis on Deutsche Bank regulation and your regulation, and why that
Well, my analysis. Well, first thing to say, securitization did have an effect, because securitization enabled the effect of the downturn in housing prices in the U.S. to be transmitted worldwide. So that, for example, a lot of German Landesbanken held very large quantities of securitized claims on mortgages. And the securitization did lead to a much greater global spreading of what was essentially initially primarily an American financial crisis. So securitization, yes, did play a role. And the derivative market, and on the whole, did not play any role in this. But people are very frightened of derivatives, in large part because they don't really understand them. And in part because, if you take the raw statistics, they're very, very frightening. And this is one of the reasons why there's a problem in dealing with finance. And it's as follows. Most banks and most investment bankers are actually much more risk averse than you think. Now, they are nevertheless trying to service their clients. So the client comes in and says, I want to have a contract with you, maybe a derivative, an option, for example. It may be a straightforward foreign exchange position. It may be that you sell them or you buy from them a security of some kind. Now, when you have dealt with your client, that makes the bank which has dealt with the client unbalanced because it was previously in a fairly hedged. Because, say, the client wants to buy something and you've sold it to them, you're now short of that, and therefore, if the price goes up, you get into difficulties. So what a bank does when it has made a transaction with a client is it offsets the vast majority of that transaction with an offsetting transaction. Now, when it does an offsetting transaction with another bank, that will put that other bank in an unhedged position. Now, I did quite a lot of work on the micro market structure, for example, of the foreign exchange market. Now, because of this trying to hedge your position, in other words, not take a risk, for every initial deal with a client, there will probably be at least 10, maybe more, further deals until everyone is happy with their degree of hedging, which means that, if you like, that global transaction are always a large multiple of the initial deal with the client. And you will frequently see, for example, in the sort of stupid press, an example that says the volume of transactions in the foreign exchange markets is 100 times or 80 times the volume of trade. That's absolute, in a sense, crap. Because, first of all, for every trade deal that is done between a bank and an exporter-importer, in order to restore the system to a desired equilibrium hedge, there will be at least sort of 10 or more transactions. And you've also got all the financial transactions. So in the relationship between transactions, foreign exchange transactions, and actual trade volume, and is bound to be huge. Now, that is probably at its most extreme in the derivative market. Any initial derivative contract made between, say, a bank or the investment bank bit of a bank and a client will generate a very large number of further offsetting trades, and what's more, because derivatives' initial position is usually balanced, and depending on the movement of market prices, the initial derivative will either be sort of positive or negative. As prices move, again in order to maintain the desired hedge position, the initial derivative position will need to be sort of managed and hedged by yet further more derivatives. So the volume of global derivatives that you have in the system is just huge. And it's in trillions and trillions and trillions. But that is in terms of trying to cope with the implications of a much, much tinier sort of volume of actual final transactions with clients. Or in other words, the net position of all of this is tiny relative to the gross position. And if you look at the gross position of derivatives, you won't stay awake, you won't go to sleep at night, because anything goes wrong, you think, oh my God, I know, it's all terrible. But again, the problem is that the sort of the network of all these offsetting hedges, of course, depends on the continuing solvency in operation of the counterparties. And that, of course, is what is so frightening when actually you have a bank which is involved in all of this, like Lehman Brothers. Because Lehman Brothers would have been involved in a huge volume of intra-financial hedging transactions. But now, which it goes insolvent, all those people who had been involved in that no longer actually knew where they stood. Now, in a sense, given the way the financial system worked, Vickers has got it completely and absolutely wrong, in that it is actually quite easy to restructure a simple retail bank. In other words, you don't actually need to provide that much sort of special support for it, because you can sell it off really dirt easily. So it's simple and easy to do. But what you can't do is to allow these big investment banks to go under because of the counterparty risk. Now, if you say that, you then say, well, isn't it very risky to have these? Because if they did go under, the problem is if you're going to have your clients involved with investment banks, and you need that because they do want to hedge their positions, clients, and they've got to do it with some investment bank, and if the investment bank goes down, it'll be real trouble, which is again one of the reasons why you would